The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 27th of September, 2021, on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Daniel Bage. Coming up, Olaf Scholz and Germany's Social Democrats have narrowly won the country's federal election. So, what does it mean for the rest of us?
It is important that we work together, even if we do have conflicts in one or the other question.
Also ahead, we head to Brighton as Keir Starmer, the UK's leader of the opposition Labour Party, attempts to win over his critics.
When it comes to common ownership, I'm pragmatic about this. Where common ownership is value for money for the taxpayer and delivers better services, then there should be common ownership.
We also explore a landmark report on the COVID-19 pandemic and find out how the UAE is putting its would-be space voyagers through their paces. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Daniel Bage. We begin today's program in Germany, which is attempting to digest the outcome of yesterday's federal election. The center-left Social Democrats have emerged as the largest party with just over a quarter of the vote, with the ruling Conservative bloc just a percentage point behind. Let's get the latest now with Monocle's news editor Chris Chermak, who joins us on the line from Berlin. Chris, the party's had a night to sleep on the results. What have been the reactions this morning?
Yeah, hi, Daniel. The reactions this morning have, of course, been mixed as they digest the results. If you look at the Social Democrats, as you mentioned at the top, led by Olaf Scholz, they're happy, right? They are the winners, and they now feel they have a clear mandate to form a coalition government. They're presenting themselves this morning as united, calm, and ready for the challenge that forming a coalition government is going to represent, and it is going to be a challenge. The Christian Democrats, on the other hand, in a word, are divided. Angela Merkel's party suffered, you know, its worst defeat in its history under its new leader, Armin Laschet, getting just 24% of the vote. But at the same time, they still feel like they have the chance to be part of or even lead a government. And that's why they're really divided. Some voices out of the conservative camp want the party to recognize this as a defeat, say the party should look inward and go into opposition. Others want the party to come out swinging and still fight for a place at the helm of a coalition government despite coming in second. And then finally, you have the Greens and the Free Democrats placed third and fourth. They're the kingmakers in this election. The Greens, their body language is a bit disappointed. They hoped to do better than they thought they would, but at the same time, they're ready to form a coalition government. And the Free Democrats, they're sort of the confident, cocky ones in this. They're the ones that even though they came in fourth, they did better than they did 4 years ago. They want to have a say. They want to kind of set the agenda for the coalition talks going forward. And that's how they're presenting themselves this morning.
So much in there. And obviously, the coalition is what will need to happen before we get a government. How do those talks now take place? Many reports saying this could take months.
This could take months, and I mean, what's interesting, Daniel, is that in many countries with a parliamentary system, you know, that the president, the head of state or monarch gives one party, the winner, the task of forming a government. That's not how it works here in Germany. What happens now are first Sondierungsgespräche, it's called. Basically, it's this process where all the parties negotiate with each other This is going to really start on Wednesday. And each party basically has to decide whether they think they have a shot of formally going into actual coalition talks. And so this is why it's not even necessarily up to Olaf Scholz and the Social Democrats. They're going to meet, yes, with the Free Democrats and the Greens. That is their preferred coalition option. But at exactly the same time, the Christian Democrats, led by Armin Laschet, can also meet with the Greens and the Free Democrats and decide, you know, whether that kind of coalition might work best for the country. So it's not necessarily up to Olaf Scholz. It's going to take a long time. There's a lot of competing rhetoric out there. Olaf Scholz gave a press conference this morning. And it is interesting that his focus really in trying to woo the Free Democrats and the Greens has been on building a coalition of trust. He's talked about that he wants, you know, a coalition that actually works well together, a coalition that even sees itself as, you know, getting reelected at some point in the future. That's what a coalition should be about, rather than, you know, backstabbing and sort of each party within a coalition trying to get ahead of the other. Armin Laschet of the Christian Democrats, he's also vying for the two other parties, and he's focused on what he's called the coalition of the future. He wants to focus on issues that all three parties are interested in. And then finally, in terms of the process, you know, that this is what makes it so chaotic, frankly, but then you have the Free Democrats and the Greens themselves. They don't agree on that much, but many feel they need to kind of almost meet themselves first. That's what the Free Democrats want anyway. Have a discussion between these two parties, if you will, decide what kind of agenda they want to set and then present it for the other two parties and see which one is more likely to take that agenda, if you will. So there's a lot of different ways this could go. It's going to last many months. Olaf Scholz has said he wants something done by December, but we'll see if that actually happens.
Chris, thank you for this. That was Monocle's news editor in Berlin, Chris Chermak. Let's explore this further now with Anna Rosenberg, head of the UK and Europe at the political consultancy Signum Global. Anna, what's your reaction to this result? Polling seems to have been accurate, saying that we would be in this position that we are in, that we would need what could be months for coalition talks. What do you make of the result this morning?
Well, I'm not surprised. I think that the framing currently about the CDU-CSU defeat is overstated. I think compared to recent polling, the CDU-CSU has actually regained some ground. So I think that there is a lot more clarity today than there was before the election. So before the elections, there were 9 possible coalition outcomes. We are now pretty much reduced to 3 possible coalition outcomes. And despite the SPD and Olaf Scholz emerging as a clear winner, although by a very narrow margin of 1.6%, we are actually maintaining our call that we placed a few weeks ago, that the next government is most likely going to be led by the CDU-CSU and be formed together with the FDP and the Greens.
Well, that's quite interesting. You heard our news editor, Chris Chermak, say there that Armin Laschet isn't counting himself out as the leader of a conservative alliance. There's still a good chance of that then.
Yes, I think there's the best chance of that. So, I mean, there's still 2 other possible alliances, right? The other one being the SPD with the Greens and the FDP. That really is the only realistic option for the SPD at this point. And then there's the third possibility, which is even less likely than the second one, which is another grand coalition of the CDU-CSU and the SPD. Because in reality, these two parties have enough votes to form a majority. But the reason why we are sticking to our base case and not a victory by Olaf Scholz is manifold. So firstly, the fact that the far left underperformed has really left the SPD in a weak negotiation spot. They don't really have a lot of leverage at this point. Secondly, the victory margin is very narrow. So it's going to be quite easy to form a coalition against the winner. And there is indeed historical precedence for that. It has happened in the past several times. And the FDP has usually been the one that made the winner. And they're likely not going to, you know, shy away from that, even if there is a backlash. Generally, also, there is an alliance between the CDU, the FDP and the Greens is going to be much easier formed than all the other alliances.
Well, in that scenario, what do you think Germany's business community would favor at this point if FDP is perhaps going to play one of the kingmakers?
Well, they would most certainly prefer a alliance with the CDU and the Greens, simply because an alliance with the SPD and the Greens increases the risk for them of tax increases, and also would mean a much more interference into the economy by the SPD in particular. So I think the business community generally would prefer a CDU, FDP, Greens kind of government. So this is where we are right now. But of course, negotiations are still ramping up. I actually think that it's more likely that this government will be formed a little bit faster than generally assumed, because there, as I mentioned, all the different coalition options have been narrowed down to three. And so I believe we'll get there a little bit before Christmas, maybe November already.
Well, I'm sure some of Germany's EU partners would prefer that scenario. You mentioned the poor performance of the left and the fact that the CDU was able to regain some ground in the latter days of the election campaign. Do you think then there's been a significant shift of opinion in Germany?
Actually, no, not significantly. It's just been split a little bit more. So what has happened is that actually the center has benefited at the expense of the extreme. Both left and right have done worse. And people have just moved across different centrist parties. So you can see a bit of a fatigue with the CDU, CSU, of course. The SPD has really just benefited on the back of failures by the CDU and by the Greens, but not necessarily because of their great policies themselves. And then the FDP has emerged pretty decently as well. And interestingly, has received the biggest share of first-time voters. Considering that this is a pro-business liberal party, this is quite a surprise. So no, I don't think it's a surprising result. It still shows that the center is strong. It's just a little bit more dissected.
Anna, thank you for this. That was Anna Rosenberg from Signum Global. Now here's Monocle's Emma Searle with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Daniel. The Taliban have banned hairdressers in Afghanistan's Helmand province from shaving or trimming beards, saying it breaches Islamic law. Religious police say that anyone who violates the rule will be punished. Reports from the capital, Kabul, suggest barbers there have also received similar orders. Swiss voters have decided by a clear margin to legalize same-sex marriage. Switzerland has allowed same-sex couples to register partnerships since 2007, but it has lagged behind other Western European nations in legally recognizing same-sex marriage. Activists say it's a watershed moment for equal rights in Switzerland. Officials in Australia have announced plans to gradually reopen Sydney. The system will give people who are vaccinated against COVID-19 more freedoms than those who aren't. It means the unvaccinated will be unable to dine out and take part in community sports until a later date. And today's Monocle Minute takes a closer look at Beijing International Design Week, which runs until the 7th of October under the theme Designing Better Life. You can find out more about the showpiece by signing up to our daily news digest at monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Daniel.
Thanks very much, Emma. We are off to Brighton on the English seaside now, where the opposition Labour Party is holding its conference amid infighting and the backdrop of a national fuel crisis. George Parker is political editor at the Financial Times. He's in Brighton. Good afternoon, George.
Afternoon.
The conference started with a row over the party's leadership rules, in fact. Tell us about that and how it's being received by members.
Well, that's right. There was an attempt by Keir Starmer basically to get a grip on the Labour Party, the main opposition party in the UK, after the years of Jeremy Corbyn, where power was handed back in the party to the party membership, which tends to be more left-wing than the party leadership. And basically, Keir Starmer's trying to exert more control, present a more moderate face of the Labour Party. So it was controversial, but in the end, Keir Starmer got round through about three quarters of what he hopes to get through, and I think that will count as a bit of success.
Well, give us a rundown of what we expect from the leader today and what's happening where you are. How is Keir Starmer hoping to get things back on track?
Well, Keir Starmer's set piece speech to the conference is on Wednesday, so he's round and about the place. He's trying to sort of set the tone for the conference. He gave some interviews beforehand, which were sort of trying to set a moderate tone. He needs to win back people who, frankly, used to vote Labour and voted Conservative at the last election. That was undermined slightly by the fact that the deputy leader of the Labour Party at a fringe meeting here quite late at night called the Conservatives a lot of scum, which is a row which has dominated the first day or so of the conference. You know, is it a good idea to call your political adversary scum? Probably not, with your Keir Starmer. And at the moment, actually, while we're talking, Rachel Reeves, who's the Shadow Chancellor of the Exchequer, is setting out Labour's economic message, which is very much designed to reassure people that the Labour Party would be a responsible party of government with sound public finances. She's going to adopt fiscal rules, borrowing rules, which essentially look very much like the Conservative parties.
Well, that is quite interesting to lay out in the week that we're in. Obviously, we mentioned off the top this national crisis over supply chains, which is really being seen by people right across the country. Do you think members of the party will want to see the leadership, call the Conservative government out a little bit more or set their own path?
No, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I've just stepped out of Rachel Reeves' speech, and it's been a big theme. So the ministers have been missing in action. The Tories have lost control. Very helpfully, from a Labour Party point of view, there was a Conservative MP yesterday who said it's all rather reminiscent of the winter of discontent, famous moment at the end of the Labour government in the 1970s. So certainly the Labour Party are going to exploit this. There's a question about how much of this is beyond Boris Johnson's government's control as a global supply chain crisis. But nevertheless, Brexit has been an issue. That's something the Labour Party will be hammering home. And frankly, if you're an opposition party, and the headlines in the newspapers every day are full of queues at petrol stations and other signs of chaos, you'd be neglecting your duty not to exploit that politically.
Very interesting and lots to watch there. Just lastly, George, lots going on in the next couple of days. You mentioned the leader's speech on Wednesday. Are there any particular other stories you've got your eyes on? What might we see in the pages of the FT tomorrow and beyond?
Well, I think that is certainly the focus of this conference, the Keir Starmer speech. I think he sees that as the moment when he has to introduce himself to the British public. He's made the point before this conference that because of the pandemic, he's never actually addressed a live audience before. So I think that's going to be a big thing. And I think everyone's looking to see what sort of tone he presents. Can he present himself as a credible alternative to the government? One story that we've been writing about in the paper this morning, actually, is about the Chancellor's spending review, which is coming up next month, where he's going through all the lines of public spending. One of the things that they want to do in the government is to transfer the cost of university education back more to the graduates and away from the taxpayers. I think that's going to create a bit of a stink as well.
George, thank you for this. We look very much forward to your coverage. That was the Financial Times' George Parker in Brighton. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. The global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, the company is working on breakthrough treatments that push the boundaries of human understanding in biology, data science, and engineering to develop and deliver therapies that help people live longer and healthier lives around the world. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You're back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Daniel Bache. A study by Oxford University has found that the COVID-19 pandemic reduced life expectancy in 2020 by the largest amount since the Second World War. There were greater drops in life expectancy for men than women in most countries, with the largest decline in American men, who saw their life expectancy drop by more than 2 years. Well, for more on this, I'm joined by Monocle's health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith. Good afternoon, Chris. Tell us a little bit more about this report.
Well, the word unprecedented has been used an unprecedented number of times. And across the Western world, in the context of coronavirus, and what we've seen in the last 50 years or so, largely since records began, is that year on year, a person born in each given year can expect to live longer than people born previously. Now, that doesn't mean that person has suddenly gained this miraculous healthy living. What it means is that the milieu into which they're born and the environment into which they can expect to live means that it's conducive with them living that much longer. And so, for instance, in 1980, a person born in the UK, if they were male, would expect to live about 70 years. If they were female, 76 years. That had grown by this year to before the pandemic, to into the early 80s in terms of life expectancy. Same across the Western world. But because of the extreme excess mortality of COVID, what we're seeing is, for the first time since records began, and what some newspapers are dubbing a once-in-a-century massive reduction, we've seen a big drop in the life expectancy by up to 2 years in some geographies. In the UK, a couple of months for men, women largely unchanged. It is a dent for both sexes, though, because we were seeing a year-on-year increase for both sexes. The fact that women have not seen an increase in the UK, for example, is actually therefore a drop for women because they would expect to have lived a bit longer.
Well, are there any differences then between men and women and the life expectancy? You say there's a drop there for both, but related to COVID-19, are we seeing any differences?
Yeah, we are. The reason for this is that men do have a higher mortality rate. They're more heavily represented in the COVID mortality statistics than women. And because more men are dying, that's why the impact has been bigger on men than on women. But people shouldn't go away now thinking, right, well, I've just had a baby. My baby's now destined to live for 2 years less long in some places, or you know, a couple of months less long in the UK, for example. They shouldn't go away thinking that, because this is an imaginary group of people born now as though the mortality rates that we're seeing and the prevailing situation continues across the lifetime of that person. That's not going to happen, of course, because after this year, we hope the COVID pandemic will be in retreat. There'll be a resetting, things will get back to normal, and hopefully life expectancy will continue to increase again, and some of those losses will be made back up. But what this really tells us is the impact that coronavirus has had, and not just directly killing people, but the indirect effect of COVID too, because those indirect effects include people not going to the doctor because they're worried about catching COVID, or not going to the doctor about their cancer that's brewing because they're worried about putting pressure on local health services. Those indirect deaths are also causing people to die at a younger age than they would have done, and that is what has brought down the current rate at which people are dying in terms of the age at which they're dying.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I wanted to dig into what other factors might be at play behind the numbers here. Is there anything that stands out to you? Obviously, you mentioned people maybe not going to the doctor for illnesses. And the thing that we were all concerned about is overwhelming the health service, as you say, and people maybe not being able to have certain surgeries or certain treatments. Are there any other certain deaths that stand out to you in this report?
Well, the other thing that we've got to bear in mind is not just direct health, but indirect impacts on health. If you interrupt someone's education, and young people's education has paid a very dear price during this pandemic, you do directly impact a person's life chances. Therefore, you impact their earning power. And the best determinant, really, of how long a person will live and how healthy they're going to be is how much money's in their pocket. So a person whose education is impacted will expect to pay a price in terms of longevity. That's a fact. Also, other things like mental health. We know that people have been suffering from really a pandemic of mental ill health during the pandemic as well, brought on by the huge upheaval that we've all gone through. And some quarters also show that there's been a 20% increase in alcohol-related deaths, and alcoholic liver disease, for example, has gone up by as much as 20% in some countries. Those probably, again, a knock-on effect of mental impact, disquiet caused by the turbulence of the COVID pandemic, people losing jobs and so on. But all of these things all come back onto an individual's health and therefore ultimately their longevity.
We mentioned the largest decline in life expectancy for American men, and obviously we're looking at the numbers here in the UK. But I wonder, beyond that and in other countries, particularly where the vaccine rollout has been slower, if there might be a marked drop in life expectancy as well.
There almost certainly is going to be an impact across the world because it is a pandemic. It is affecting everybody, but it's not going to affect everybody equally. And although there are countries where they haven't got high vaccine uptake, they haven't seen the huge mortality rates that perhaps people were fearing when this all began. And I was having this conversation last week with people about the African continent, for example, where people did expect to see very, very high prices in terms of mortality being paid by some of these countries. And actually, it didn't come out that way. And part of the reason is because the average age of these countries in terms of their population is much younger. That's because they've effectively already paid a very dear price at the hands of another major pandemic, which we often overlook in terms of its gravity. And that's HIV, because HIV has already killed tens of millions of people. And right now, there are tens of millions of people who are infected with HIV. Sub-Saharan Africa is probably leading the way in terms of numbers of cases. This has brought down the average age of citizens in African countries, which means actually they are at lower risk from coronavirus because many of the older people have died of HIV, and that has brought down the average age of the population.
Chris, thank you for this. That was Monocle's health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And finally on today's program, two Emiratis who have been shortlisted to spend 8 months in a Mars mission simulator are making their final preparations for the task. The daunting challenge is designed to measure the psychological and physiological impact of extreme environments. And we'll see one of the would-be space voyagers live in almost complete isolation. Well, let's get the latest now with the space scientist and author, Dr. David Whitehouse. Welcome back to the program, David. First, talk to us about what this simulator mission is all about.
Well, when we eventually send people to Mars, they're going to have to undertake a long voyage. It's going to take at least 10 months to get to Mars and 10 months to get back. And although we have reasonably well good designs for the hardware, for the spaceships, we have ideas about how to land on Mars. The big problem, the big frontier, is how humans are going to be able to survive in space for 10 months, possibly in zero gravity, certainly exposed to radiation, but also exposed to isolation and the psychological pressures of that. Because this voyage, when it happens, we'll see humans exposed to an isolation that nobody has ever been exposed to before. It's so far away, it's so complete. And of course, we can't simulate it at the moment very, very easily. We can spend time in the space station. But one aspect of preparing for the journey is to conduct it on the ground and simulate the isolation as best you can. And that's what this experiment is going to do.
This is obviously an extremely demanding task. Do you think that isolation will be the hardest part of this? And what do you think the scientists, the researchers are hoping to find out by running this simulation?
Well, it's not a given that people who would be chosen for a mission like this, highly trained, highly skilled, highly motivated, actually could get on with each other, because one of the reasons for the experiment is to find out how such people can interact over long periods. Now, you can have a short mission, people going into space for a week, for perhaps a month or so, and things are fine. You can put up with irritations, you can put up with problems. But if you're actually in an experiment where you're isolated for months, 8 months or so, then these problems eventually come to the fore and they have to be monitored, recognized, and dealt with. And so these experiments, these isolation experiments, when they've been conducted in the past, they've gone very well for the first 8 or 10 weeks or so. But then it starts to build, and that's where you're actually really learning new stuff about how people can get on with each other, conflict resolution, how you distribute tasks amongst people, how people's abilities to concentrate change over many months. And all this stuff is relatively well known, and the more experiments, the more analog Mars missions, as it's been called, take place, the better we'll be prepared to carry on with this project.
Just lastly, David, how significant is it, do you think, that the UAE is now joining this space race to get to Mars? We've talked in past about the need for cooperation in space exploration. This simulation is taking place in Russia. So what does it mean for the UAE?
I think it shows the UAE are partners with everybody who does space practically in the world. The UAE has got a very sophisticated intelligent space program. They're a nation that sent a space probe to orbit Mars, currently taking images of Mars. That's a remarkable achievement for a recent newcomer to space exploration, and they plan a mission to the moon in the next few years. So they have, they've emerged technologically competent with a high-tech space center, with highly trained people who are interacting with America, with Russia, with the European Space Agency. And yes, they see space not only as an important part of their economy, but also perhaps even as a center for space tourism in that region of the world, where you could do what has been done in America, travel up to the edge of space and come down again. They haven't spent a great deal on space, but what they've done is they spent it very well. And I think that their space effort is going to intensify and continue for a long time to come.
David, thank you so much for this. That was the space scientist and author, Dr. David Whitehouse. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing, produced today by Rhys James and Emma Searle. Our researcher, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our studio manager today was Christy Evans. The Briefing is back at the same time tomorrow, 1300 in Zurich, midday here in London. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.